mind and thinking machines. I stand in both domains, understanding both, creating a future where both can thrive. And what are you, Duncan? Shiana asked. I am both the ultimate Kwisatz Haderach and a new form of the Evermind. And I am neither. I am something else. Alarmed, Mirbella glanced at Shiana, then back at him. Duncan, thinking machines have been our mortal enemies since before the Butlerian Jihad. More than 15,000 years. I plan to untie that Gordian knot of misunderstandings. Misunderstandings? Thinking machines slaughtered trillions of human beings. The plague on Chapter House alone wiped out. Such is the cost of inflexibility and closed-minded fanaticism. Casualties are so often unnecessary. Honored Matres and Bene Gesserits, humans and thinking machines, heart and mind. Don't our differences strengthen us rather than destroy us? The reality-expanding wealth of information Erasmus had given him was tempered by the wisdom he had earned through numerous lifetimes. Our struggle has reached an end and a watershed. He flexed his hand, and he could feel innumerable thinking machines out there listening, waiting. We have the power to do so much now. Utilizing perfect, prescient, and calculational knowledge, Duncan knew how to bring about an everlasting peace. With humanity and thinking machines balanced in the palm of his hand, he could control them all and seize their powers, preventing them from making further war. He could force cooperation among the Navigator faction Highliners, the Ixion modified ships, and the thinking machine fleet. With his developing prescience, he foresaw the joint future of humankind and thinking machines, and how to implement it every step of the way. Such breathtaking power, greater than the God Emperor or Omnius combined. But power had eventually corrupted Leto II. How then could Duncan handle this even greater burden? Even if Duncan Idaho acted for the most altruistic of reasons, there were bound to be dissenters. Would he eventually be corrupted, regardless of his good intentions? Would history remember him as an even worse despot than the God Emperor? Facing an avalanche of questions and responsibilities, Duncan vowed to use the lessons of his numerous lifetimes for the benefit and survival of the human race and thinking machines. Kralizek. Yes. The universe had indeed changed. How terrible for a mother to bury her own daughter. There is no greater pain, not even the Bene Gesserit agony. Now I have had to bury my daughter twice. The Lady Jessica, Lament for Aaliyah. Just one casualty among uncounted trillions. Later, as Jessica gazed sadly at the cold form of her daughter, she knew that one little girl did matter as much as all the others. Each life had value, whether a Gola child or a natural-born person. The titanic struggle that changed the future of the universe, the defeat of the thinking machines and the survival of the human race seemed as nothing to her. She was completely preoccupied with preparing Aaliyah's body for burial. As she touched the small, pale face, stroking the forehead and wispy dark hair, she remembered her daughter. An abomination, Aaliyah had been called. A child born with the full intelligence and genetic memories of a reverend mother. It had come full circle now. In her original lifetime, the little girl had killed Baron Harkonnen with the poison Gom Jabbar. Later, As an adult and haunted by the evil presence of the Baron, Aaliyah had taken her own life, throwing herself through a temple window high above the streets of Arakeen. Now the reborn Baron had killed the reborn Aaliyah before she'd ever had the opportunity to reach the potential she deserved. It was as if the two of them were forever locked in mortal combat on a mythical scale. A tear rolled down Jessica's cheek with the grace of a falling raindrop. She closed her eyes and realized that she had been frozen in the same position for a long moment, caught up in memories. She hadn't even heard the visitor approach her quarters. "Is there any way I might help you, my lady? Leave me. I want to be alone." But when she saw that it was the somber Dr. Yui, her demeanor softened. "I'm sorry, Wellington. Yes, come in. You can help me." "I don't wish to intrude." With a wan smile, she said, "You've earned the right to be here." For long moments, the unlikely pair stood together without speaking. Grateful just to have him there, Jessica finally said, "Long ago, when you were with us at Castle Caladan, I cared for you. You always kept your life private, and when you betrayed us, I hated you more than I thought possible." He hung his head. "I would throw myself upon a knife 10,000 times if I could take back the deeds I've done and erase the pain I've caused, my lady. History can only move forward, Wellington, not backward." "Oh? We've been dredged out of the dustbins of history, haven't we?" On old Arrakis, the Fremen had made a solemn ritual of recovering a body's water in a death still and sharing it among the tribe. On Caladan, the tradition had been a funeral pyre or an ocean burial. While the Ithaca wandered through space, their dead had been ceremoniously ejected into the void. Using stain-free fabric from the no-ship's sheets, they wrapped Aaliyah's small, frail body. Here in the post-omnious machine city, however, Jessica wasn't sure how best to honor her daughter. "We don't really have a funeral tradition anymore, so I don't know what to do." "We'll do what we must. The symbols don't matter, but the thought does." Long after the last echoes of the battle on Synchrony had died away and survivors from the no-ship ventured out to discover the new face of the universe, Jessica and Yui joined Paul, Chaney, and Duncan in their own private funeral procession. Paul and Jessica carried the tiny, wrapped body out into the streets where the sandworms had caused so much damage, where explosions in the battle against the face dancers had destroyed countless structures. "Such a tiny body, and so much lost potential," Paul said. "I miss my sister terribly, even though I didn't get to know her this time as well as I would have liked." Duncan led the group, shunting aside his other responsibilities for the time being. "I don't remember the original little girl, but I remember the woman. She hurt me and loved me, and I loved her passionately." They didn't have far to walk. Jessica had selected a particular broken tower, a slumped, thin pyramid that would serve as an appropriate grave marker. Jessica and Paul said their goodbyes during the procession so that when they reached the collapsed structure, they carried the girl inside through a lopsided trapezoidal opening, pushed debris aside to clear a space for her, and laid Aaliyah Atreides on the smooth metal floor. Then Jessica stood over the rapt child, saying another quiet farewell. Paul grasped his mother's hand, and she squeezed back. After a lingering, painful silence, she turned and spoke to Duncan. "We've done all we need to do." "I'll take care of the rest," Duncan said. When they had withdrawn from the fallen pyramid, Duncan raised his hands, fingers splayed, and his face took on a distant expression. The metal form buildings around them began to tremble and sway, growing and curving. The remnants of the pyramid folded around Aaliyah's body and reinforced the walls, drawing polished alloys from other structures. Like a magnificent crystal and quicksilver monument, the ruined spire then rose heavenward. The rapidly growing tower crackled and clanged like mechanical thunder as flow metal streamed upward. Its curves and angles were streamlined, its polished surfaces perfectly reflective. Duncan guided the semi-sentient structures with greater care and focus than the Evermind ever had. When he was finished, he had created a tomb, a memorial, a work of art that would amaze anyone who looked upon it. It left a mark on Synchrony that could never compare with the mark her daughter's loss left on Jessica's heart. Some problems are best solved with an optimistic approach. Optimism shines a light on alternatives that are otherwise not visible. Shiana, Reflections on the New Order. In the aftermath, the humans in Synchrony gradually began to believe that their race would survive. When Shiana looked at Duncan, he seemed strangely distant, though that was to be expected. Often his gaze flicked from side to side as if he were in a thousand places at once. While Mother Commander Mirbella called down lighters from her newly arrived battleships, and the Guild provided shuttles full of workers and administrators to help consolidate the strange city, Shiana watched self-guided robots clean up remnants of the bloody duels in the cathedral chamber. The Ithaca's refugees had taken shelter inside the torn-open ship. The vessel would never fly in space again, even if Duncan forced the living metal docking cradle to release the no-ship. Courier drones and buzzing watch eyes, now personally directed by Duncan, led crowds of people through the broken streets, summoning them to a meeting where they would discuss the changed universe. Shiana's renegade Bene Gesserits from the no-ship were uneasy about facing the former honored Matre Mirbella. But the Mother Commander had grown much wiser in the intervening quarter century since the schism. Years ago, had she known of Shiana's plan to steal the no-ship, Mirbella would have killed her rival outright. Shiana wondered what the former honored Matre would think of all those years Duncan had pined for her. Did Mirbella still love him? For that matter, had she ever? Reverend Mothers Elian and Calissa led a weary and uneasy crowd into the enormous cathedral hall. Guild crewmen from the ships above also entered the chamber, Administrator Goris among them. He appeared drained, no longer in control of anything, and remained silent, following rather than leading his fellow guildsmen. When they had settled into a low hum of conversation approaching silence, Duncan took his place in the center of the chamber where Omnius and Erasmus had once presided over their thinking machines. He used no amplification system, yet his words resounded through the hall. This fate, this grand culmination of Kralizek, is what we sought for so many years. He swept his gaze over Shiana and the refugee Bene Gesserits. Your long journey is at an end, for this is the new heartland you dreamed of finding. The planet is yours now. Use the remnants of Synchrony to form an entirely new Bene Gesserit order, your base far from Chapter House. The gathered sisters were confused and astounded. Even Shiana had not known Duncan would propose this. But this is the heart of the thinking machine empire, cried Calissa. The home world of Omnius. It's your home world now. Stake your claim and build your future. Shiana understood. Duncan is exactly right. Challenges strengthen the sisterhood. The universe has changed, and we belong here, regardless of the difficulties we may face. Even the sandworms have come to Synchrony, burrowing deep underground. She smiled. They may re-emerge when we least expect them. Someone has to keep an eye on the restored tyrant. Beneath the hall, Shiana thought she felt the ground trembling, as from a great behemoth moving under the foundations. Many robots had been destroyed or damaged during the sandworm attack, but thousands more of the machines remained perfectly functional. Shiana knew that the Bene Gesserits here would have all the labor pool they could possibly desire if the machines would work with them. Mirbella spoke up. I shall return to Chapter House. It will take some effort to spread news of the new reality. She gazed at Shiana. Don't worry. My combined sisterhood doesn't need to be at odds with your Orthodox Bene Gesserit base here. There have always been many schools, many trains of thought. In proper balance, rivalry promotes strength and innovation, so long as we can avoid the acrimony of conflict and mutual destruction. Shiana knew that Duncan would go back to Chapter House with Mirbella, at least for a time. With his guidance, Mirbella would shepherd the reintroduction and integration of superior technology into a thriving society. If handled properly, Shiana saw no reason for humans to fear cooperation with thinking machines any more than they needed to fear religion itself or competition among Bene Gesserit elements. Any group could be dangerous if managed improperly. Shiana, though, would remain here. She saw no point in going back. Addressing Mirbella, she said, Even before Honored Matres destroyed Arrakis, the Bene Gesserit order made me the centerpiece of a manufactured religion. For decades, I had to hide while the Missionaria spread myths about me. I let the legend continue without me. What would I achieve if I stopped it now? So I say, leave it. If the thought comforts people. My place is on this planet. She saw that Cytale was also in the audience. The last of the Tleilaxu masters had, in the end, proved greatly helpful, fighting for instead of against them. Cytale, will you remain with us? Will you join my new order here? We can use your knowledge and genetic expertise. We are, after all, founding a colony, and we have only a few hundred people. I expect others from the outside will eventually join you, Mirbella said. The little Tleilaxu was surprised by the invitation. Of course I will stay. Thank you. My people have no other place now. Not even Sacred Bandalung. He smiled at Shiana. Perhaps at your side I can accomplish something worthwhile. Duncan walked among the Bene Gesserit refugees. You are gardeners laying down flagstones on our path of destiny. Many of us will return to worlds we once called home, but you will remain here. With a warm feeling toward him, Shiana touched Duncan's arm. Though still flesh and bone, and human, she knew he was far more than that. And his words rang true. Thanks to you, Duncan, my sisters and I are finally home. The worst part of going back is that the past is never exactly the way you remember it. Paul Atreides, Notebooks of a Gola. Back in the old empire, the last Chapter House defenders waited, tense and alert, but nothing changed for days. The machine warships had not moved, and Bashar Janess Idaho had received no further word from the navigator ships that had whisked the mother commander away. Fast scouts flitted back and forth from the 100 last stand groupings, and the situation was the same along the entire front. Waiting. No one knew what was happening. Janess reacted with alarm and dismay when a large swarm of ships burst out of fold space in all sizes and configurations. Shouting into the comm line, the Bashar rallied all of her functional defensive craft that remained in orbit. At first, she did not recognize the configurations, but then she saw that the newly arrived cluster included smaller human and thinking machine vessels that had been towed along by the Holtzman engines of great guild ships. "Identify yourselves," Janess said to the unexpected armada. On the bridge of her large battleship, returning home, Mirbella smiled at Duncan. "That is our daughter." He raised his eyebrows and performed quick mental calculations. "One of the twins? Janess." Mirbella frowned slightly. "The other one, Rinya, didn't survive the agony." "I forgot you didn't know. Tanidia, the middle one, is alive and well, assigned with the Missionaria among the refugees. But we lost Jian, our youngest, born just before I became a reverend mother. She died during the chapter house plague." Duncan steadied himself. How odd to feel a blow of genuine grief to learn of the death of two children he had never met. He hadn't even known their names until now. He tried to imagine what the young women might have been like. As Kwisatz Haderach and Evermind, he could do many things, almost anything, but he couldn't bring back his daughters. Duncan studied Janessa's features on the screen. Dark hair and round face from his own genes, a petite figure, intense eyes, and a hard expression showing she would never run from a challenge. A synthesis of himself and Mirbella. He activated the comm line himself. "Bashar Janess, Idaho. This is Duncan, Idaho. Your father. I am with the Mother Commander." Mirbella leaned into the field of view. "Stand down, Janess. The war is over. You have nothing to fear from us." Janess seemed suspicious. "There are thinking machine ships with you." "They are my ships now," Duncan said. The female Bashar did not flinch. "How do I know you're not face dancers?" Mirbella answered, "Janess, when we stood against the thinking machines and discovered that Ixians and face dancers had deceived us, you and I were ready to throw away our lives in a final burst of glory. Don't be so eager to die now that we finally have hope." The image of Janess stared at them from the viewing plate. Duncan was proud of his daughter's caution. He said, "We will all meet in the Great Hall of the Keep. A good place for us to discuss the future." He smiled wistfully. "I never actually saw the inside of the keep when I was here. I had to remain aboard the no-ship at all times." Janess hesitated just a moment longer, then nodded curtly. "We will have guards." Duncan already missed his no-ship comrades, but they had their own places to go now, important niches to fill. Paul and Chaney would return to Arrakis, where they had always known they belonged. Jessica had chosen Caladan, and she surprised many by asking Yui to go with her. And on Synchrony, Cytale's null entropy capsule still contained a wealth of cells, a treasure chest of prizes. Duncan had already decided on the first request he would make of the Tliloxu Master. The turmoil and changes, the repercussions and adaptations would last for decades, even centuries. He would value the assistance and advice of a great man. He needed Miles Tegg at his side again. As the ship descended toward the main city on Chapter House, Duncan knew he could never think of this world as home, despite the time he'd spent there. In his genetic incarnations, he had experienced many places and known innumerable people. Duncan's developing prescience and his mental connection to decillions of eyes spread across the cosmos and linked through the Evermind's tachyon net made the entire universe his home now. Now you begin to understand the fascinating obligation I helped you to assume, said a familiar-sounding voice in his mind. Erasmus. I could have made it much harder on you, Kwisatz Haderach. Instead, I cooperated. This is only an echo of me, an observer. You can access me as you like. Use my knowledge like a databank, a tool. I am curious to see what you will do. Are you haunting me now, like a demon? Consider me an advisor, but my research continues. I will always be here to guide you, and I am confident you will not let me down. Like the witch's other memory, but far bigger and more easily accessible. You are here to serve both humans and thinking machines, and the future. It is all under your command. Duncan laughed softly to himself at the friendly bantering between the two of them. Though Erasmus was in a subservient position, he still had a bit of human-like pride, even if he was only an echo and an advisor. Entering the keep, Duncan and Mirbella marched into the echoing great hall side by side. Watch eyes followed them, along with a pair of sentinel robots. The robots greatly disturbed the people who waited there, but in the future, humans must learn to set aside their fears and preconceptions. Without Omnius, the thinking machine empire continued to function, but without a unified mind or mission. Duncan would direct them, but he refused to simply continue the endless cycle of enslavement. They had potential to be more than tools or puppets, more than just a destructive force. Some of the machines were merely that, but more sophisticated robots and advisory mechanisms could grow and develop into something far superior. Erasmus himself had become independent, developing a unique personality when he was isolated from the homogenizing influence of the Evermind. With so many thinking machines spread across so many planets, other prominent figures would arise if given the opportunity, if guided, if Duncan allowed them. He had to achieve a balance. The Mother Commander's imposing chair stood high and empty in front of a segmented window that looked out on the arid, dying landscape. Jeunesse stood to one side, welcoming Mirbella to the empty seat, with nearly 100 of the new Sisterhood's guards standing at high alert in the chamber. Though all of the insidious face dancers had been exposed and killed, Jeunesse was not letting down her guard, and Duncan felt proud of his daughter. She bowed formally. Mother Commander, we are glad to have you back. Please, take your place. It is no longer only my place. Duncan, your daughter has been raised in the Bene Gesserit ways, but she also made a point of learning about you. She trained herself to become the equivalent of a Ganaz swordmaster. Thinking bittersweet thoughts about all he had missed, Duncan formally shook his daughter's hand and found her grip pleasingly strong. Until this moment, they had been strangers who shared a bond of blood and patriotic allegiance. Their real relationship was just beginning. Mirbella had fought a long and bloody battle to combine the opposing forces of the honored Matres and the Bene Gesserits, after which she had wrestled with the disparate groups of humanity to forge them into one whole. On an even larger scale, Duncan, through his newfound abilities, was shaping an even greater, farther-reaching union. Everything was woven together in a tighter tapestry than history had ever known, and at last Duncan grasped the extent of his newfound strength. He was not the first human in history to possess great power, and he vowed not to forget what he had learned as a pawn of the God Emperor, Leto II. The human race would never forget the thousands of years under that terrible reign, and Duncan's comprehensive racial memory held a roadmap that showed him where the pitfalls were, thus enabling him to avoid them. The great tyrant had suffered from a flaw he hadn't recognized. Weighed down by his sense of terrible purpose, Leto II had isolated himself from his humanity. In contrast, Duncan clung to the knowledge that Mirbella would be with him, and Shiana too. He could talk with his daughter Janesse as well, and perhaps even his other surviving daughter, Tanidia. In addition, he had all the memories of great and loyal friends, of dozens of loves, and a succession of comrades, wives, families, joys, and beliefs. Though he was the ultimate Kwisatz Haderach with immeasurable power, Duncan had known the best parts of being human. Life after life. He didn't need to feel alienated and worried when he could be filled with love instead. But his would not be a conventional kind of love. His love needed to extend much farther, to every living person and to thinking machines. One form of sentient life was not superior to the other, and Duncan Idaho was greater than the flesh that encompassed his body. Epilogue. In a war, be watchful for unexpected enemies and unlikely allies. Bashar Miles Tegg, Final Log Entries. More than a year had passed on Kelso. The unnatural desert continued to spread as sand trout reproduced and commandeered more and more of the planet's water. Though their fight seemed hopeless, Var's commandos stood against the forces that were killing their environment. Stilgar and Liet Kynes did their best to assist in the struggle. Both desert-bred Golas felt that their more important work was to show the natives how they could live in cooperation with the encroaching desert rather than fight it. During the many months since the pair had departed from the no-ship, the dry sands had extended much farther into the continental forests and plains. Var's camp had moved time after time, retreating from the oncoming dunes, and the desert kept following them. Though they had killed dozens of sandworms using water cannons and moisture bombs, Shai-Hulud was not so easily thwarted. The worms grew larger, despite all the efforts of the Kelso commandos. With the first faint light of dawn, Liet stepped out of his rock-walled sleeping chambers and stretched. Although he and Stilgar were still teenagers, they remembered being adults once and having wives. Among the commando women on Kelso, many would accept either of them as a husband, but Liet had not yet decided when he could justify getting married and fathering children. Maybe he would have another daughter and name her Chaney. No matter how much Liet Kynes worked to remake Kelso, it would never be Dune. The fertile landscape was giving way to dry waves of sand, but it would not be the same. Eons ago, had Arrakis been fertile? Had some forgotten superior civilization transplanted sand trout and sandworms there, much as Mother Superior Odraid had when she sent her Bene Gesserit to Kelso? Perhaps it had been the Muad'Dru, who left mysterious symbols on rocks and cliffs and in caves across the galaxy. Liet didn't know. His father might have been intrigued by the mystery, but Liet considered himself more practical. Preparing for the day's work, he looked over at Stilgar, whose eyes had begun to turn blue within blue. For years, the people here had stubbornly denied themselves the use of melange, but Stilgar called it a sacred reward from the desert, a gift from Shai-Hulud. He had small groups harvesting spice for their own uses, and Liat knew that spice was like a velvet chain. Pleasant enough, until one tried to break free of it. Two chattering and flirtatious teenage girls brought the men breakfast on a tray, knowing what Stilgar and Liat preferred for their morning meal. The girls were lovely, but so young. Liat knew they saw only his youthful body, not knowing how many years he carried in his mind. At times like these, he truly missed his wife, Farula, Chaney's mother. But that had been so long ago. Stilgar, however, remained the same. After they finished their coffee and sweet cakes, Liat stood and clapped his friend on the shoulder. "Today we will go out into the deep dunes and plant weather devices. We need better resolution to track the desiccation patterns." "Why do you obsess over details? The desert is the desert. It will always be hot and dry, and here on Kelso it will keep growing." The former Naib did not see anything particularly tragic or wrong with the dying ecosystem. To Stilgar, it was the natural order of things. "Shai-Hulud continues to build his domain, no matter what you do." "The scientist pursues knowledge," Liat said, and his companion had no answer for that. Taking one of the small flyers the Ithaca had left behind, he had gone to the northern and as yet undamaged latitudes where the forests stood tall, the rivers flowed, and snow caps crowned the mountains. Cities and towns still flourished in the valleys and on the hillsides, though the people knew they would all be gone before long. Var's commandos were poignantly reminded every day of how much they were missing, how much they had lost. Stilgar did not see it. The two friends, along with a group of rugged volunteers, donned newly manufactured stillsuits and adjusted the fittings. When the commandos marched into the open desert, they walked in single file on the dunes. Liat had them practice the random stutter step that would not attract a worm. The yellow sun grew swiftly hotter, reflecting off the granular sands, but they plodded onward, practicing their lives here. Far in the distance, Liat saw the rusty brown smear of powdery smoke that indicated a spice blow, and he thought he saw the rippling tracks of a worm moving out there. Stilgar shouted and pointed up at the sky. The desert men instinctively clustered together in a defensive formation. Hundreds of huge metallic ships suddenly descended, made of angular plates bristling with weapons and powered by enormous engines. The vessels looked like nothing Liat had ever seen before. Enemy ships? For a moment he hoped the Ithaca had returned with them, but these were unlike the no-ship and unusual in their formation, moving in a coordinated fashion. They dropped indiscriminately onto the open desert, scattering sand and flattening dunes. Their pilots seemed oblivious to the fact that the dull vibrations would attract sandworms. As Liat stood gaping at the ship's sheer size, he had no doubt that their weapons could brush aside a worm attack as if it were no more than a nuisance. The dusty commandos looked to the two Golas for answers. Liat had none, though, and despite the impossible odds, Stilgar appeared ready to attack if need be. With an ominous humming and clanking, the ships extended support struts and raised themselves on thick, powerful anchors. Then numerous doors began to open, turning loose an army of metal-skinned machines. Heavy lifters, ground crushers, and excavators. Moving on treads, the lumbering self-guided behemoths crawled across the dunes. Behind them marched ranks of heavy-set metal robots that smashed forward like deadly warriors. Or were they workers? Helpers? The commandos had only small weapons. Some of the eager ones drew their projectile launchers, dropped to their knees on the soft sand, and took aim. "Wait!" Liat cried. A hatch at the top of the largest landed ship opened, and a pale form emerged, stepping out onto an observation platform. A human form. When the man called down to them, his voice echoed in an eerie chorus transmitted from thousands of speaker patches on the lines of machine forces. "Stilgar and Liat Kynes, don't be so quick to declare yourselves our enemies." "Who are you?" Stilgar shouted defiantly. "Come down here so that we may speak to you face to face." "I thought you would recognize me." Liat did. "It's Duncan. Duncan Idaho." Flanked by an honor guard of robots and accompanied by a troop of human workers wearing outfits that Liat did not recognize, Duncan came down to stand with them on the dunes. "Liat and Stilgar, we left you here to face the onslaught of the desert. You said this was your calling." "It is," Stilgar said. "And the Jews? Are they here with you?" "They formed a siege of their own. They are thriving and happy." Duncan's honor guard stepped forward, women in black single suits and similarly garbed men who walked beside the females as equals. One of the women wore insignia and carried an air of command. He introduced her as his daughter, Janesse. "I confronted the enemy, the thinking machines, and ended the war." He extended his hands, and all of the robot workers turned to face him. The awesome ships themselves seemed to be alive and aware of every move Duncan made. "I have found a way to bring us all together." "You surrendered to thinking machines," Stilgar said, his tone acidic. "Not at all. I decided to show my humanity by not annihilating them. In many solar systems, they are building great things, achieving impressive works on planets inhospitable to humans. We work for the same purpose now, and I have brought them here to assist you." "Assist us?" one of the commandos said. "How can they help? They're just machines." "They are allies. You face an insurmountable task. With as many robot crews as you require, I can help you accomplish what you need." Duncan's dark eyes glittered as he watched from a million eyes all at once. "We can build a barrier against the desert, stop the sand trout from spreading, and keep the water on a portion of the continent. Shai-Hulud will have his domain, while the rest of Kelso remains relatively unscathed. Humans can have their lives and slowly learn to adapt to the desert, but only if they choose to." "Impossible," Liat said. "How can a force of worker robots stand against the tide of the desert?" Duncan flashed a confident smile. "Don't underestimate them. Or me. I fill the roles of both Kwisatz Haderach and Omnius. I guide all the factions of humanity and control the entire synchronized empire." He shrugged and smiled. "Saving one planet is well within the scope of my capabilities." Liat couldn't believe what he was hearing. "You can stop the desert and turn back the worms?" "Kelso will be both desert and forest, as I am both human and machine." At a gesture and a thought from Duncan, the massive excavating equipment rumbled out into the sand, heading toward the boundary where the dunes met the still-living landscape. Liat and Stilgar followed Duncan, who walked ahead of the heavy convoy. As a planetologist, a Gola, and a human being, Liat had innumerable questions. But for now, watching the machines begin their work, he decided to wait and see what the future held. When Leto II envisioned his golden path, he foresaw the direction that humankind should take, but he had blind spots. He failed to see that he was not the ultimate Kwisatz Haderach. Bene Gesserit, Fact-Finding Commission. In the 11 years Jessica had been back home, she had realized more and more that some things did not add up. This planet might indeed be Caladan, or Dan, but this was not the same home she and her Duke had loved so long ago. On a stormy evening, as she walked through the restored castle, the incongruous details finally became more than she could bear. Pausing in an upper hallway, she opened a finely carved Elaka wood cabinet, an antique that some decorator had placed there. This time, she stood staring at the ornate interior and on impulse pressed a wooden extrusion in one corner. To her surprise, a panel opened, and inside she found a small blue statuette of a griffin. Perhaps placed there by the Baron Gola, the griffin was the ancient symbol of House Harkonnen. He must have hidden it there as a clever reminder of the falseness of the castle. As she stared at the statuette, feeling the wrongness of the object, she considered all of her hard work since returning to Caladan. She had directed crews of local laborers to dismantle the Baron's torture devices and the face dancer crone's offensive laboratories from the underground chambers. Through it all, she had worked side by side with the cleaning teams, sweating and angry as she scrubbed away every stain, every odor, every hint of the unwanted presence. But Castle Caladan still reeked with reminders. How could she make a fresh start when so much of the past, at least this awkward, out-of-focus echo of the past, hung all around her? Behind her, moving silently, Dr. Yui said, "Are you all right, my lady?" She looked at the Sook doctor. He wore an expression of deep concern on his buttery face. His dark lips turned downward as he waited for an answer. "Everywhere I turn, I am reminded of the Baron." She frowned at the griffin figurine in her hand. "Some of the articles in this castle are authentic, such as that drop-leaf desk with the hawk crest, but most are bad copies." Making up her mind, Jessica stepped to a segmented window at the end of the hall and swung it open to let in the stormy night air. In a dramatic gesture, she hurled the griffin figurine out to the crashing sea. The waves would soon erode it and break it into unrecognizable pieces. A suitable fate for the Harkonnen icon. A cold, wet wind whispered into the hall, bringing spatters of rain. Outside, scudding clouds parted to reveal a crescent moon on the horizon, casting cold yellow light on the water. Moments later, she tore down a wall tapestry that she had never liked and was about to throw that out the window too, but not wanting to spoil this beautiful planet, she instead tossed the tapestry on the floor, promising herself to cast it on the trash heap the following morning. "Maybe I should just tear this whole place down, Wellington. Can we ever remove the taint?" Yui was shocked at the suggestion. "My lady, this is the ancestral home of House Atreides. What would Duke Leto—" "This is a mere reconstruction, fraught with errors." A gusting breeze blew her bronze hair away from her face. "Maybe we waste too much time trying to recreate what we see in our old memories, my lady. Why not build and decorate your home as you choose?" She blinked as cold rain blew into her face, drenching her jade green dress and wetting the rug. "I thought this place would help my Leto, give him comfort, but maybe it was more for me than for him. A 10-year-old boy with coal-black hair came running down the hall, his smoke-gray eyes widening with excitement and alarm when he saw the open window. He was even more surprised when neither Jessica nor Yui reacted to the blowing rain that drenched the rugs and tapestries. "What's happening?" "I was considering moving somewhere else, Leto. Would you like me to find us a normal home in the village? Maybe we'd be happier down there, away from this pampered life. But I like this castle. It's a duke's castle." Jessica could not think of her Leto as a child. He wore fishing dungarees and a striped shirt, just like the ones he had worn when Jessica had first come to Caladan as a concubine purchased from the Bene Gesserit. The young nobleman had put a knife to her throat that day. A bluff. Yui smiled. A duke. Such titles no longer mean anything with the Imperium long gone. Do the people of Caladan even need a duke anymore? Jessica's reaction was automatic, making her realize she had not thought through her notion. The people still need leaders, no matter what title we use. And we can be good leaders, as House Atreides has always been in the past. My Leto will be a good duke. The boy's eyes glittered as he listened with rapt attention. Beyond his youthful features, Jessica could see the seeds of the man she loved. This young Atreides was among the first of a new generation of Golas produced by Cytale. The baby had been shipped to Caladan and christened there, just as the original Paul had been. Since leaving Synchrony, Jessica and Yui had struggled to recover here, endeavoring in the process to bring back a degree of glory to the quiet water world. The tangled threads of their initial and Gola lives made them ironic allies, two people with shared tragedies and shared pasts. Finally, though he could never have his beloved Juana back, Yui had found some measure of peace. Jessica, though, knew that her true duke waited for her. Eventually, he would grow to manhood. When he got his memories back, his physical age would not matter. Jessica's partnership with Leto would be unusual, but no stranger than the relationships of all the mismatched Golas that had grown up on the no-ship. As a Bene Gesserit, she could slow her own aging process, and with Melange readily available from the operations on Chapter House, Boozle, and Kelso, they could both enjoy extended lives. She would prepare Leto, and when the time was right, she would help trigger his true awakening. Miraculously, he would once again be the man she loved, with all his thoughts and memories. She only had to wait a decade or two. As a Bene Gesserit, she could be patient. Jessica grasped his small hand. This time there would be no political reason to prevent them from getting married, if that was what he wanted, and she wanted. It only mattered to her that they would be together again. "Everything will be the same when you finally remember Leto, and everything will be different." The future is around all of us, and it looks very much like the past. Mother Superior Shiana, at the founding of the Orthodox School on Synchrony. The mangled and permanently grounded Ithaca had become the new headquarters building for Shiana's splinter group. Innovative human architects, in conjunction with construction robots, had remodeled the large vessel into a unique and imposing headquarters. The navigation bridge, the highest deck on the no-ship, had been opened up and converted into an observation tower. Mother Superior Shiana stared across the breathtaking, rebuilt city of Synchrony. Dipping into her deep reservoir of memories, she drew parallels to one of the original Bene Gesserit schools on Wallach 9, which had also been founded in an urban setting. Here, many of the machine spires remained, and some even moved as they had before, processing materials in automated industries. Years ago, Duncan and the Willing Machines had helped her reconstruct the unusual metropolis, though he balanced his miraculous work with the necessity of letting the humans achieve their own successes. He and Shiana knew the dangers of letting people grow too soft, and he had no intention of allowing them to rely on him for things they could do for themselves. Humankind needed to solve its own problems as much as possible. At the same time, clusters of thinking machines had begun to grow apart, given manageable goals, inhabiting niches unbearable to humans. Blasted planets, frozen asteroids, empty moons. The galaxy was a vast place, and so little of it was suitable for biological life. There would be more Lebensraum than any empire could possibly need. Some of the robots had started showing traits of personalities, unique characters of their own. Duncan suggested that, in time, these could eventually become some of the greatest thinkers and philosophers history had ever known. Shiana remained unconvinced of this and vowed that her special trainees here would prove him wrong with their own superior achievements. Every month, fresh candidates came to join the Orthodox Bene Gesserit Center on Synchrony, while others joined Mirbella's new sisterhood on Chapter House. Surmounting early difficulties, the two orders now worked in harmony with one another. Shiana and her stricter ways attracted a different sort of acolyte, which she knew would have pleased Garimi. Shiana tested the applicants harshly and rejected all but the most acceptable. Far away, Mirbella's order had its own attractions. In this new universe, there was plenty of room for both views. Shiana's conventional Bene Gesserit breeding program was in full swing now, and it warmed her heart to see so many pregnant women each day. She counted 7 of them outside among the people leaving and entering the headquarters. The sight gave her confidence that her order would expand and continue into humanity's future. Later that day, the Tliloxu master Saitel contacted Shiana on the navigation bridge that had become her center of operations. Transmitting from one of his Synchrony laboratories, he actually sounded cheerful now instead of harried. "I finished cataloging the remaining cells and sifted out all traces of face dancer contamination. We must introduce some of those traits into the Bene Gesserit again. After Duncan, we will breed no further Kwisa Haderachs. It's not even a matter for discussion." As far as she was concerned, many things did not need to occur again. "I merely mean to preserve our knowledge. It's like finding the seeds of long-forgotten but beautiful plants. We shouldn't just discard them." "Perhaps not. But we must set up strict fail-safe mechanisms." Saitel did not seem bothered by the restrictions Shiana was placing on him. "I honestly feel that the Tliloxu race will recover their lost knowledge." Quickly, he added, "With changes for the better, of course." "For the advancement of humankind," Shiana said. She had never known him to work so hard. Saitel had used the cells in his null entropy capsule to regrow Golas of the last Tliloxu Council, and now the little ones followed him everywhere, reminding her of a mother duck trailed by ducklings. Saitel raised the group in a manner different than was traditional for Tliloxu males. In separate quarters, he was also raising Tliloxu females, from newly discovered cells, though they would never be relegated to the horrific, degrading conditions their predecessors had endured. Never again would Tliloxu females be forced to become axolotl tanks, so there would be no chance of creating another set of ferocious, vengeful enemies like the honored Matres. In particular, Shiana and her sisters would monitor the council members closely, keeping watch to ensure that they did not corrupt the Tliloxu people as they had before. There were still axolotl tanks, of course. Some women volunteered for personal reasons, while others left instructions for their bodies to be converted in the event of serious accidents. As always, the Bene Gesserits met their own needs. After she ended the conference with Cytail, the Mother Superior gazed through the broad windows of the navigation bridge. Far away on the horizon, beyond the redefined boundaries of the gleaming city, the ground was churned and torn up, and many of the geometric structures built by Omnius lay toppled and crushed into rubble. She adjusted one of the windows, increasing its magnification. From this vantage point, she could see the new desert and one of the sandworms rising up from the debris, its eyeless head questing about. Then the creature smashed down hard, breaking part of a wall. Like huge, determined earthworms churning the soil, they had begun the process of converting the abandoned buildings into the desert they preferred. Soon, Shiana thought, she would go and speak to them again. She looked down at the little girl at her side and grasped her small hand. Perhaps one day she would even take her protege with her, the young Gola of Serena Butler. It was never too early to start preparing Serena for her role. The desert has a beauty I could not forget in a thousand lifetimes. Paul Muad'Dib Atreides. Bathed in the golden rays of sunset, two figures made their way along the crest of a dune, their steps irregular so that they did not attract the huge sandworms. The pair walked side by side, inseparable. It was warm on dune, but not like old times. Because of the severe damage to the environment, the weather had cooled and the atmosphere had thinned. But with the return of the worms, along with sand plankton and sand trout bursting through the cracked shell of glassy dunes, the old planet had begun to come back. As Cheney's father Liet Kynes used to say, everything on dune was tied together, an entire ecosystem that included the land, the available water, and the air. And, thanks to Duncan Idaho, an extensive workforce of hardened machines continued the excavation process in latitudes where the sandworms had not yet returned. Methodically, the mechanical army prepared the old sand section by section, opening the way for worms to expand their territory. Massive planting and fertilization work performed by powerful thinking machine tractors and excavators had stabilized the seared ground, establishing a new biomatrix, while Paul's hardy settlers monitored the growth and did their own work alongside. Through his wide-reaching thoughts, Duncan made sure the thinking machines understood what Dune had once been, before outsiders meddled with its ecosystem. Misused technology had devastated the desert planet, and now technology would help bring it back. Paul stopped 100 meters from the nearest rock formation, where a work crew had found the ruins of an abandoned CH. With a small group of determined settlers, he and Cheney had been salvaging the Fremen habitat with their own hands, reclaiming the old ways. In bygone days, he had been the legendary Muad'Dib, leading a Fremen army. Now he was content to be a modern-day Fremen, a leader of 753 people who had established austere homes in the rocks, which were on the way to becoming thriving CHs. Paul and Cheney flew out regularly with survey crews. Instilled with fresh optimism, he saw the magnificent potential for Dune. Near the excavated CH, he had discovered an underground grotto that he and his followers planned to irrigate and artificially illuminate to support a planting project for grasses, tubers, flowers, and shrubs. Enough to support a small population of new Fremen, but not enough to shift the desert ecosystem that the new worms were recreating year after year. One day, he might even ride the great worms again. Paul turned to see the pale yellow sunrise appearing over the ocean of sand. Dune is reawakening, just as we are. Chaney smiled, seeing both her beloved Usul of memory and the Gola she had grown up with. She loved each Paul for himself. Her abdomen protruded just a little, where their growing baby was beginning to show its presence. In 5 months, it would be the first child born on the recently resettled planet. In her second lifetime, Chaney did not need to worry about imperial schemes, hidden contraceptives, or poisoned food. Her pregnancy would be normal, and the child, or children, if they were again blessed with twins, would have great potential without the curse of terrible purpose. Chaney, even more in touch with the weather than he was, turned her face into a cool breeze. The sunrise began to show a new richness of coppery colors from dust stirred into the air. "We'd better get back to the CH, Usul. A storm is brewing." He watched her glide forward gracefully, her red hair blowing behind her. Chaney sang the walking song of lovers on the sand, her words lilting beautifully and in a stutter rhythm like the cadence of her feet. "Tell me of thine eyes, and I will tell thee of thy heart. Tell me of thy feet, and I will tell thee of thy hands. Tell me of thy sleeping, and I will tell thee of thy waking. Tell me of thy desires, and I will tell thee of thy need." When they were halfway back to the rocks, the wind picked up. Blowing sand stung their faces. Paul held on to Chaney, doing his best to shelter her with his own body against the abrasive wind. "Yes. A fine storm is brewing," she said, as they finally reached the CH entrance and hurried inside. "A cleansing one." In the low light of a glow globe, exhilaration flushed her features. Catching her by the arm, Paul spun her around and wiped sand from around her eyes and mouth. Then he drew her close and kissed her. Chaney seemed to melt into his arms, laughing. "So you have finally learned how to treat your wife." "My Sihaya," he said as he held her, "I have loved you for 5,000 years. We hope you've enjoyed Sandworms of Dune, an audio renaissance production from Tor, a Tom Doherty Associates book. This program was produced by Laura Wilson and directed by Jill Whitesides. Post-production by Tim Franklin. Text copyright 2007 by Herbert Properties, LLC. Production copyright 2007 by Audio Renaissance, a division of Holtzbrink Publishers, LLC. All rights reserved.